Our exhorter this evening is Brother Jim Washick. His subject is Ecclesiastes, the tenor and teachings of the preacher, and he has no reading, so we will turn it over to Brother Jim.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
I am kind of challenged when it comes to electronics. As you can see, the topic, well, first of all, can everyone hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Ecclesiastes, the tenor and teachings of the preacher. The general teachings of the book of Ecclesiastes include that man is a mortal creature, and in the matter of life and death, the natural man has no preeminence above a beast. That men under divine law will be brought to judgment. And it is affirmed on the basis of Solomon's wisdom and personal experience that all the pleasures and luxuries which seem so desirable at first glance or from a distance fail to live up to the expected satisfaction after they are possessed. For indeed, all natural things in this life are in the end vanity and vexation of spirit. Ecclesiastes gives us the clearest statements of facts which are recognized and admitted by those of advanced age, but generally overlooked and perhaps even scoffed at by youth, explaining Solomon's attention in this book to addressing youth. And these include such facts as life, for the most part, is a troubled and disappointing experience when we look back from advanced years. That's not to deny many good memories. And it is tragic to be cut off by injury or death when still able to work and enjoy pleasure, but just as tragic to live until all those powers have gone. And one or the other of those situations is the natural portion of every human being. Again, statements that have more meaning to us as we reach advanced stage. Well, this is certainly getting off on a somber note. But although in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon underscores the vanity of the human condition, he also spells out the purpose of life and a way to escape that vanity. Essentially, he tells us, it's foolish for a young person to dedicate himself to a desperate search for that which is beyond most of our reach. For even if by chance, and of course chance can happen to anyone, he should gain his coveted prize, he would find after all his labor that there was no enduring satisfaction in it. And therefore, Solomon teaches, it is good for a young first person to find his pleasures in the simple blessings of life, which are near at hand, for those, he says, are the gift of God. What are they? Such everyday things as the labor which God has decreed. That is, the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return into the ground. Labor occupies us. Labor gives us a sense of worth and achievement, not to mention refreshing sleep. Another simple blessing given us is family, the husband or a wife of our youth, with whom we share life's trials and pleasures, with whom we grow old with, responding to and supporting one another in love and care. And our children, to whom we dedicate our love, our time, our wisdom, our example, and in whom we find purpose. We are to enjoy the simple blessings, for they are the most satisfying that mortal life has to offer. And you will find this a theme throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. We note also Solomon's insistence on the recognition of God as the author of all blessings and the judge of mankind, stressed again throughout his book. It is a truth on which we must lay hold and from which our attention must not be withdrawn or distracted by either the pleasures or the trials of life. we are reminded that it is he which feareth God that shall come forth of them all. And as Solomon so poignantly reminded his young charges, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. It is perhaps hard to understand that the emphatic condemnation of human pride and the scorn of luxury should come from one who had experienced all the temporal advantages which wealth could give. Yet it is so understandable that through Solomon's pursuit of pleasure, he lost sight of the simple, more satisfying life choices. And only afterwards did he recognize his folly. So before moving on to examining some of Solomon's individual teachings, which is the focus of this hour, let us consider the significance of the author himself. Although many have argued to the contrary, there can be no reasonable doubt that the book of Ecclesiastes was indeed written by Solomon. There is no difficulty in tracing the identity of the son of David, who reigned as king in Jerusalem, who had come to great estate and had increased more than all that were before him. Yet some might ask, does it really matter who authored the book? Well, perhaps in one sense, no. Yet in another, absolutely yes. Consider how greatly Moses' writings are enhanced by our knowledge of the man who wrote them. And would we not say the same of Paul's writings? In like manner, a book written by Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived, demands our utmost attention because of our knowledge of the author. Although the writers of the scriptures were moved by God to perform their task, their participation was not involuntary. God uses the individuality of men, and he selects men accordingly to accomplish his purpose. Their thoughts, their actions, their experiences, and their works all contribute to impress upon us truths through that very meaningful context. So we might say that the Spirit has stamped the man Solomon on these writings. We approach the book of Ecclesiastes knowing that God has employed in its production the wisest, richest, most powerful, and perhaps the most renowned of Israel's kings. Ecclesiastes is just unique. Beyond its solemn contemplations, the book is just full of wise sayings, commentary on mortal life, and the exposure of human pretense. I want to encourage you to examine some of Solomon's wisdom in the light of your own experiences as servants of the Most High. Reasoning naturally, we might expect to find a model of righteousness in Solomon's example. And yet, as we all know, his wisdom did not always move him in the way of righteousness. In the scriptures we will consider, we need to keep in mind that Solomon is not glorifying the events of his life, not by any means, but is rather summing up his experiences and his conclusions when he's looked back on them. It's a summary. The detail of his experiences have to be sought out elsewhere in the scriptures. When we examine the book of Ecclesiastes side by side with the inspired account of Solomon's life, we find it reveals a very sad picture of a man who in substance says, do as I say, but not as I have done. It contains the writings of a wise man on the folly of his own actions. It shows, moreover, that wisdom did not prevent his folly. Fear God and keep his commandments, says the wise man, for this is the whole duty of man. Sound advice. But did Solomon always follow it? The scriptures reveal that he did not, for in many ways he set aside even the Mosaic ordinances, flagrantly so, as in the matter of his alien marriages. though Solomon does not directly mention that subject in his writings, he reveals the workings of his mind in relation to it. Note, I applied mine heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. What a significant comment this is upon his own personal experiences. A conclusion reached not merely by observation, but by experience. That Solomon did not escape the type of woman to which he here refers was shown in the altars he built around Jerusalem to Chemosh and Molech and the other heathen deities worshipped by his wives. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, although God had said that Israel's kings were not to multiply wives to themselves. And what do we read? And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. They included princesses from Egypt, Moab, Ammon, Edom, Sidon, and Heth. It is remarkable that this wisest of all men gave to his heir Rehoboam an Amorite for a mother. Note his comment on his experience in this connection. He selects a number exactly equal to that of his wives and concubines. And he says, "Behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one, to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among 1,000 have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found." Now what a confession for such a man to make with his 1,000 wives in view. Not one of them, not one, did he consider worthy. That there were God-fearing women in Israel at that time we cannot doubt. For Solomon's own book of Proverbs contains a beautiful description of perfect womanhood. The passage is well known. Who can find a virtuous woman, for her price is far above rubies? The heart of her husband does safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Such a valuable helpmeet was not found by Solomon, though they surely were by some of his people. Why not Solomon? Well, God-fearing women were not to be found among the princesses of Egypt and Moab and Edom and Ammon and Zidon and Heth. There's a lesson here. How often do those who contemplate an alien marriage say to themselves and others, "I will never forsake the truth"? Let all give heed to Solomon's terrible example. Let us remember that with all his wisdom, he was unable to resist the alien influence which he brought into his own life, and the result to him was, in his own words, more bitter than death. Speaking of idolatry into which his unfaithful alliances, led him, God said, "For as much as this is done of thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant, my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and give it to thy servant." We, no less than Solomon, are called to rulership in the future kingdom of God. Now is our testing time as to whether or not we will keep God's commandments and statutes. If our desires and alliances go to the world, we might be deemed unworthy. We will be deemed unworthy of a place in the kingdom. Had Solomon utilized his wisdom in maintaining the straight and narrow way, what a different example he would have provided. And it's no wonder that in summing up his experience, he should say that all is vanity and vexation of spirit, and that he hated his labor and his life. Because he spent so much of it reveling in pleasure and in the riches of the world. What a contrast we find in Paul in summing up his life. When martyrdom was staring him in the face, and when he was deprived of liberty and forsaken by most men, what did he say? I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at that day, and not to me only, but unto all them that love his appearing. Solomon reveals his experience in confessing, I will be wise, but it was far from me. He could not escape the effects of his flesh and the situation that he brought upon himself. He could not depend upon his own wisdom, and neither can we. Consider the parable of the 10 virgins. It would seem that the foolish virgins' 12th hour awareness of their lack of readiness to meet their Lord, and their request to their fellow virgins to give us of your oil, mirror Solomon's statement, in effect saying, well, I will be wise now. But in truth, wisdom was far from them, as it will be for us if we live our lives predominantly after the pleasures and the prospects of this world. Okay, let's move on now to examine the wisdom of some of Solomon's, I think, difficult verses. Verses hard to be understood in light of our own experiences as servants of the Most High. And I want to first look at Ecclesiastes 1:18. For in much wisdom is much grief. He that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Wisdom brings grief, and knowledge brings sorrow. Is that right? Is that apparent to us? Is that the thing that pops to mind with wisdom and knowledge? In this first chapter of the book, we have a description of the passing generations, of day and night, of flowing rivers, the return of the waters to their fountainhead, the movement of the winds according to their circuits. There is here clearly a recognition of underlying laws in these observations of nature. But how does it pertain to one of the themes of the book, that with increased knowledge comes increased sorrow? We note that after mentioning these processes of nature, the tone of the preacher becomes somber, and he reflects that all things are full of labor, that there's nothing new under the sun, and that the searching out of wisdom, of the wisdom of all things are done under heaven, is a sore travail which God has given the sons of men to be exercised therewith. The marginal rendering of that is to afflict them. It would seem Solomon is reflecting on the passage of time and the events which reflect that passage, the generations, day and night, flowing rivers, etc., things which go on indefinitely, while he and we do not. We are temporary of but a few days, and our lives are characterized by travail. The generations pass, and often there is no remembrance of those who have so painfully labored in the past. This consideration, this lesson is given that our minds might be exercised by it, and that we might be humbled by it. This verse we're considering is the final verse in the first chapter, within which Solomon makes this statement, that in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. This is not a pleasant thought, but it is true and inseparable from the nature and experience of human existence. Consider, brothers and sisters, wisdom in Solomon made Christ a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. His wisdom brought him distress through the contemplation of human folly. And he told his disciples in Luke 12:50 that he was straitened, translated distressed, by the knowledge of the bitter trials that were yet to come. Also, we see Christ weeping over Jerusalem, distressed by the folly of his brethren, of its citizens. Certainly it is true that our eternal hope constitutes a joy far greater than the cares of this life. But it is equally true that our joy and zeal for our life diminishes as wisdom and knowledge increase. When we begin truly to understand human nature for what it is and human ways and values for their vanity. We need only ask ourselves, how often are we disappointed with our fellows and they with us? Even in the ecclesia where we mingle with earnest and zealous believers. As we age, we can look back and find many causes for sorrow coming through experience and increased knowledge. Regret for our own failures and sins are rightfully, as David stated, ever before us, constantly popping back into our minds as a reminder of what we are capable of, as are such memories of lost ones, of loved ones lost, and the toll of different tragedies experienced. We may look back at friends or brethren we were close to in former days, but who have abandoned us are the truth. Past bonds with others in the truth, which seem so secure, but which have become undone through controversy and division. As we look back, the reason for the break may be obscure, but there is no denying the estrangement, the disappointment, and perhaps even the bitterness that still lingers. How often do we see brethren parting on minor parts, points of differing judgment? And not only parting, but perhaps becoming the bitterest of opponents, losing all affection for those they formerly loved, perhaps pursuing them with relentless animosity, barring the door to peace. How is it that men who know the Scriptures can be so cruel and unfair? Well, the answer is easy. It's our nature. It's what we naturally are. It is the thinking of the flesh and the deception of the heart. Let us beware. Truly it is said, he that increaseth knowledge of the human experience and folly increaseth sorrow. Let's look at another verse, Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. To everything there is a season. And a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. All Bible students are familiar with these words. And although perhaps few could recite the whole of the examples on the board, all would remember a time to be born and a time to die. Fundamental facts we are not allowed to forget. The 13 other times mentioned may not so readily come to mind. Well, some might say, well, so what? These are merely platitudes, and the many examples given here only point out the obvious. Well, you know, that may be true. But unfortunately, so many of life's tragedies are caused by neglect of the obvious. A writer may perform a greater service by reminding us of truths with which we ought to be well acquainted than by a strenuous effort to find something new. Unfortunately, an obvious truth demands no attention and may be dismissed from the mind before its implications even have time to be grasped or pondered. So it has been with these well-known words of the preacher. You know, how might we apply some of these verses ourselves? There is obviously a time to be born. But sometimes we tend to forget that every newcomer, including us, has everything to learn. And there must be a birth date for every idea which takes root in the mind and which enters into and impacts the life and the personality of the grown person. We know there's a time to die. But for most of our lives, do we not ignore that fact? The fact that this rule applies to us as it does to all living, that it sets a limit to our opportunities and accomplishments, which we should be daily cognizant of. Death, when it claims us, ends both our life and our probation. We know there's a time to plant and a time to root up. If we are gardeners, we know too that in the most obvious application of this, the neglect of work at the right time brings an inevitable retribution. Plants failing, weeds flourishing. But in a less evident application, perhaps the majority of parents fail, often with deplorable results for their children. At a time when the young are most impressionable and growing, learning the fastest, parents may fail to plant the right conduct and ideas in those young minds. Later, they may fail to pluck up harmful conduct and ideas that have somehow got planted. Children are too often left to learn many of the facts of life from undesirable companions, and soon the time passes for either effectual planting or rooting out. In our dealings with others, mistakes are continually made which might be avoided if we had a better grasp of this principle of the proper times, as here stated by Solomon. Appropriate for this practical work comes a reminder that there's a time to speak and a time to keep silent. The Lord Jesus approves those who confess His name before men and condemns those who fail. This puts the emphasis on the saying that there is a time to speak when we might feel the inclination to remain silent despite there being an opening to speak, but the circumstances might seem unfavorable or the company most unsympathetic. We can always find excuses to remain silent, even when the truth is being directly challenged. Brethren, our light is to shine before all men. All men are as the proverbial swine in relation to divine things until they have received some measure of instruction. If no effort were ever made to teach them, their position would remain hopeless. And it is possible to teach them a little without trying to give them all the pearls of divine truth which they could not possibly understand in their current state. The point is, we should not refrain from giving an elementary lesson or hint merely because the intended recipient seems uninterested or maybe even antagonistic, that we may fail to motivate others to enter the straight and narrow way that leads to life. We might just open a door for them a little closer to that gate. There are many factors to consider in determining the time to speak and the time to be silent. It may be prudent to speak in regard to some matters and keep silent regarding others. The only rule is to speak, I think, when we have a helpful message to deliver, to be silent when we have nothing of substance to contribute. But everything boils down to a matter of times and seasons. We know that these are the times of the Gentiles during which the disciples of Christ are put to trial, derided, despised, hated, and persecuted. We see atheists and secularists attacking and persecuting Christians worldwide. The Islamists who believe they do Allah's service by killing those who claim the name. Scripture tells us that when disciples are persecuted in one city, they may flee to another, or failing to escape, must be prepared to suffer. The time will come for the saints to possess the kingdom, but that time is not yet, and the matter of time makes all the difference. In the day of weakness, Christ refused the use of the sword. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world." When He comes in power and glory to reign, we're told, in righteousness He will judge and make war. Many claim to understand the principle that for everything there is a season, everything there is a time and a season for every purpose. They may call it a truism while dismissing any attempt to emphasize it, and yet the history of the world is full of complete and tragic failures in this regard. A king of Judah became a leper because he failed to remember he was living in a time when the kingly and priestly offices were separate. The Jews rejected their Messiah because they failed to discern the difference between Christ's time for trial and sacrifice and his time for kingship. Jerusalem was overthrown and made desolate. Why? Because she did not know the time of her visitation. Luke 19:4. With so many examples of failure, should we not be hesitant to imply that this principle, that there is a season and a time to every purpose, is so obvious that it needs no emphasis, or that we understand it so fully as to need no reminders? A third difficult verse, Ecclesiastes 3:11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Well, what's so difficult about that? Well, what does it mean? He hath made obviously refers to the work of God. But his time does not necessarily mean God's time, as it would here seem to be indicated in the Authorized Version. Young's literal translation renders this first phrase, "The whole hath he made beautiful in its season." This seems to be the idea that just as there is a time for every person, so there is beauty in all things in their proper place and season. The English Standard and the Revised Standard Version both render it the same. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Everyone should agree that our perception of beauty changes with age and mental development. As we age, we recognize beauty in things and situations that did not impress us at all in our childhood or our youth. Our appreciation of things is affected by circumstances which influence our perceptions. It's not unusual to suddenly discover beauty and appreciation for something that has been there all along. The change is in us and not in the object of our attention. In that respect, beauty has its season. Although the word beautiful refers to something attractive in our language, Scripture uses the word in an extended sense. The word appearing in Ecclesiastes is also interpreted fair, goodly, pleasant. But for example, beautiful for situation, as it's used in Psalms 48:2, means something more than a pleasing configuration of the surrounding hills. David's reference to the beauty of holiness means something much more than what the eye can see. In like manner, there is good reason to believe that the word beautiful is used in a deep sense in the passage under review. In fact, we might say that the context demands such an extended interpretation. The preacher in the previous verse to this, verse 10, refers to the travail which God has given to the sons of men to be exercised thereby. Such exercise, however sore or painful, is intended to produce good results. As the Apostle Paul expresses the matter, no chastening for the present is joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it brings the fruit of righteousness to those who are exercised thereby. It is after contemplating the exercise of this travail that the preacher declares that God has made the whole experience beautiful. When? In its season. The book of Ecclesiastes reflects Solomon's wisdom in response to his experience and his travail. His contemplations and teachings are so very deep that the casual reader will miss them entirely. Consider the following statement from a past Christadelphian writer. When sin entered the world and death through sin, the human trial began. For although transgression resulted in much evil, it also made allowance for virtues that would never have existed in Eden. Courage, self-sacrifice, pity, and the lack are only possible in a world where there is fear, selfishness, cruelty, and need. Think about that. When sin entered the world and death through sin, the human trial began. For although transgression resulted in much evil, it also made allowance for virtues which would never have existed in Eden. Courage, self-sacrifice, pity, and the like are only possible in a world where there is fear, selfishness, cruelty, and need. The knowledge of good and evil came as a result of transgression. Struggle, sorrow, and death entered the world. But with the evil came the possibility, the prospect of a higher good than ever have could have been obtained in a garden of innocence and inexperience. We should all at least be able to realize that the sore travail given to man had a purpose. A purpose beyond the limits of mortal life. We may also realize that if all things can be seen in their proper season, in their setting, and understood in reference to their intended purpose, God has made the whole experience beautiful. One final verse to consider. A summing up, so to speak, will revolve around Ecclesiastes 5, 19 and 20. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. What an interesting and thought-provoking verse, a tough verse. For there is so much meaning expressed in it. In a manner, it is an answer to the travail and grief and sorrow that Solomon presented to us in his previous verses. I want to share some thoughts regarding these verses with you, which were inspired by an article appearing in the July 1961 Christadelphian magazine attributed to a brother, Cyril Cooper. Many passages in the book of Ecclesiastes at first sight are really not all that easy to understand, and this is certainly one of them. The meaning may be made clear in the rendering of the Revised Standard Version. Every man also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and find enjoyment in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. That meaning becomes even clearer when we read the verse immediately preceding, again from the RSV, which says, "Behold, what I have seen to be good and to be fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life, which God has given him, for this is his lot." This is what God gives us. In other words, man can look for nothing better in this life than to enjoy the gifts God has bestowed upon him, including the gift of toil, the sweat of his brow. God provided that man would not only be occupied, but would find fulfillment and enjoyment in these things and would be so mentally engaged in them that he would not dwell on the brevity and the vanity of life. What wisdom when you're creating temporal creatures to make life enjoyable and fruitful for them. Now, at first sight, this teaching may seem to be at variance with much of what we hold most dear and most greatly cherish, and that it may seem a challenge to the assurance of our faith in something beyond this life. But it's not that. There is a reminder here that in considering this book and its teachings, we must place them in their proper perspective. Solomon probes the problem of man's relation to his own life, asking, what is life worth? And what does it amount to when it's lived as an end in itself? Just to enjoy, eat, drink, and be merry, and enjoy. Like in musical compositions, there are dominant themes running throughout Ecclesiastes. And the dominant theme most recounted by men regarding this book is vanity of vanities, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That phrase, vexation of spirit, is also rendered striving after wind, implying activities without any true reward. This is how Solomon presents this present life with all its enjoyments and experiences of pleasure and toil when it's lived as an end in itself and not for God. This dominant theme runs through the whole book, and when reading Ecclesiastes, we have to keep that theme in mind. We must also keep in mind that this book does maintain a balance in its teaching. While it portrays life with all its frustrations and vanities and limitations, it does not hide nor overlook the many pleasures and delights that God has provided. A man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and drink and to be merry, for that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. God in his goodness has provided most generously for his creatures, intending that mortal life might be enjoyed. Solomon presents mankind in his writings not as self-creating or self-sufficient creatures, but as the creative work of a being infinitely greater than themselves. Now note, Solomon sets the stage and lays his scene in the verse on the screen under the sun. Under the sun, an all-encompassing field of the world with its wonders, its beauties, its pleasures, and its limitations. But action takes place. We see individual men, just for a brief moment, appear on the stage. They engage our attention momentarily as we read the Bible, while they respectively strive and toil and enjoy, but then they quickly pass away from the scene. Where does the stage leave us? The scene itself remains, though individual men may be seen on it for but a fleeting moment. Solomon's focus is above the stage, focused on the great designer of all, the one who set the stage, who arranged the scene, the creator and sustainer, the invisible, the eternal. The thoughts and expressions that we find in the book of Ecclesiastes relate to the all-encompassing presence of God. For it is God who gives and who orders, who judges and who rewards, as we read in our subject verses. Every man also to whom God hath given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and find enjoyment in his toil, this is the gift of God. God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. Scripture reminds us of God's greatness in contrast to our individual insignificance. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God. For God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. Therefore, let thy words be few. And the concluding chapter begins with the words we all know very well. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. Because what happens when you get older? Sorrow, grief. So even in the enjoyment of the things of this life, there is to be recognition of man's dependence upon and responsibility to God, as opposed to just living and enjoying life as an end in itself. Solomon says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, we're all aware of the world's opinion of the book of Ecclesiastes. Their opinion is just a pessimistic book, reflecting only a fatalistic outlook. Why is it that Ecclesiastes comes across as so pessimistic? Does it merely reflect Solomon's realization of the inevitability of death and the ultimate futileness of human schemes and achievements, that all that he had and built was going to be left to others and eventually disappear? Much of the Christian world thinks so, as reflected in numerous sites on the web, such as this one from Bible Notes. This Ecclesiastes is in general is a pessimistic book with statements that history merely repeats itself and nothing is new, and there is no reason to think about what might have been. The pessimism is most pronounced when considering man and animals returning to dust and not knowing where their spirits go. Well, what a shallow opinion. We know different. This book has a high calling and a meaning that must be sought out to be discerned, reflecting upon men's lives through spiritual eyes and spiritual wisdom. Though Solomon is the target of the critic's scorn, we find the tenor of his teachings reinforced by Jesus, the apostles, and the prophets, all of which lift our gaze so that we see not only the natural things on earth, the stage, but more importantly, we see what's above it. Let us conclude. In the 104th Psalm, the psalmist contemplates the wonderful provision of nature and is moved to exclaim, O Lord, how manifold are thy works. In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy riches. And indeed, the earth is full of our Creator's riches. And we share and we delight in them. We are also conscious of the universe that surrounds the earth, a universe of a vastness beyond our powers of comprehension. And on this tiny planet itself, we are conscious of the effect of the sun and the solar system, of day and night, of seed time and harvest. We realize these forces operate together to bring about marvelous results, which are greatly to the benefit of mankind. We recognize furthermore that these so-called natural forces go about their work with an artistry that appears to go far beyond what would appear necessary to attain their essential results. An artistry that brings ardor and beauty and joy to the hearts of men and women, filling them with awe and wonder as they contemplate the power and wisdom that lies behind this wondrous creation. As Isaiah 45:18 declares, it was formed to be inhabited. And do flowers really need to have all those wonderful colors, or could we have gotten by with less? It is a marvelous creation. Unlike the evolutionist, we know the Creator that confers upon His creation such manifold pleasures and blessings and the ability to delight in them. And again, the theme, every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Okay, so much for man in his relation to the present. How shall these present blessings and enjoyments and delights be regarded by men and women of God? Should we seek to disparage life's comforts and spurn all the enjoyments that come with this present life? Are we to work to limit our appreciation for the wonders and beauties of this world and the good things that human minds and skill have been allowed to accomplish? In other words, is our vision of the future to be so all-encompassing that we refrain from the joys of the present? There have been some religions that have called for just that response. Even the Christian faith has known ascetics who impose upon themselves such austerity and discipline that denies all that which makes life pleasant and enjoyable as God intended it to be. We brothers and sisters and friends must not spurn or disparage the lawful pursuits and delights that God has provided to make our lives productive and enjoyable. As Solomon declares, they are the gift of God. We accept these things as evidence of God's loving goodness and mercy, to be enjoyed as such with deep appreciation and heartfelt thanksgiving. They are, of course, but tokens of the abiding joys that God has in store for those who endure to the end. But let us at the same time never forget that this is a creation which has become scarred, bruised, and subject to vanity. Our hope is in the expectation of the manifestation of the sons of God. And our last slide. For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Note the plan and purpose of God is spelled out here. We wouldn't have chosen these trials for ourselves. God in His wisdom knew that only those trials could produce what He was looking for. It is through our faith and hope in Jesus that we might truly appreciate life's blessings and God's great gifts to their full. Brethren, peace and wealth came suddenly to Solomon. That combination gave him a unique opportunity for luxury and royal display. He enjoyed it to the full, and he pronounced it all a vain striving. He declared that a man with one wife whom he loves, with sufficient food and raiment, and a definite task at which to occupy himself, is as happy and fortunate as any human being can be. So far as mortal life is concerned, there is nothing better than this. Such a judgment could not come with the same force from any other man who ever lived. The critics who quote isolated passages from the book of Ecclesiastes to prove that the author was an utter pessimist misrepresent him. When we read the book of Ecclesiastes with understanding, we find a message very much in harmony with the gospel. Not only in harmony, but so reflective of its deeper meaning and purposes. Man is mortal. Life is short. Increased knowledge brings increased sorrow. But in love and service to God, there is the promise of righteous judgment and of life everlasting. A most beautiful end when that season arrives. Thank you.
Thank you for your words, Brother Jim.